I'm Laura Flynn, and this is Making Contact.
We elect the president, we don't elect these bankers, and yet the influence tends to be pretty equal.
Railroad, telecommunications, steel. In the early 1900s, mega mergers created industrial giants. Known as a trust buster, Theodore Roosevelt came to the presidency challenging many of the monopolies. At the time, J.P. Morgan was the quintessential American capitalist, king of Wall Street, responsible for the consolidation of major companies still around today. These two seemingly opposing forces built a relationship that allowed each to maintain power in their respective spheres.
J.P. Morgan, who had been the most powerful financier the country has ever known and the most astute political financial power behind the presidency, who really created in his time when he was running the Morgan Bank a path that really informs what happens today between political and financial alliances.
On this edition of Banking Contact, we'll hear a speech by journalist and former managing director of Goldman Sachs, Noemi Prinz, about her book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Prinz retraces the relationship between American bankers and presidents stretching over a century. From family friends and trusted confidants to the present day, how the relationship has deteriorated and presidents have lost control of the economy. She begins with the Panic of 1907.
There was a common occurrence going on. There had been speculation gone wrong, and as a result, a particular bank, it was called the Knickerbocker Trust Company, was going under. The reason it was going under was because depositors were freaking out because their money was in this bank, and it had been discovered that some of the leaders of this bank had made really bad bets in copper. They had tried to rig the copper market. Really, the rigging of the markets has been something that has happened for more than a century, but this particular moment started an entire arc of historical events that really gets us to where we are today. Because Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president at the time, he was friends with J.P. Morgan. They were in the same social class. Their families hung out. They knew each other. They trusted each other. They had close personal connections. And Teddy Roosevelt, even though he came to power as this big trust buster and a progressive president and all of that, he never busted the banks. And on that day, in 1907, when the Knickerbocker Trust Company was falling apart, when there were people from Fifth Avenue to Harlem, the rich, the poor, were all trying to get their money out of this bank, and there was panic in the streets, there was policemen with clubs beating these people back, things were going haywire, and Teddy Roosevelt was scared about his next presidency. So he says to J.P. Morgan, "You take care of it." And for the first time in U.S. history, he asked the Treasury Department give money to a private banker to help to bail out the situation. And the Treasury Department announced they would give $25 million to Morgan for him to decide what to do with to save the situation. And in addition, because that wasn't enough, Morgan gathered some of his friends together. One of them was James Stillman, who was the head of National City Bank at the time. And the National City Bank and the Stillmans and the Morgans in general were very closely connected. Their families were very closely connected. And these men sit in a room, and J.P. Morgan just says, "You're all going to put in some money, and we're going to find extra money, and we're going to save the situation here because we just can't have this continuing." He didn't put any of his own money in. In fact, he asked James Stillman to ask the Rockefellers, who ran Standard Oil Trust, if they could sell some shares so they could get oil money so they could pay to have some of these banks saved. But he took the credit for it, and he was lauded as a king, literally a king, by the New York Times for saving the country. This was in 1907. He didn't use his own money. He opened the Treasury Department for the first time ever, and he got Teddy Roosevelt to never get in the way again of any of the banks. And that, the idea that banks could not be trust busted and that this political financial power could be used so behind the scenes in such a ultimately public fashion, really started back then. After he was lauded, J.P. Morgan decided, you know what, this cannot stand. We need to have another form of money making so that I don't have to get my friends together at night in my library or get money from the Treasury Department. All that part's actually okay. But we have a central bank, which became the Federal Reserve, which will back us. But what I did is I actually went to Jekyll Island which was the birthplace of the meeting that spawned the Federal Reserve in 1910. And what happened was, J.P. Morgan was not at the meeting, but he sponsored the six people that went to Jekyll Island to discuss the foundation of the Federal Reserve. And the reason that that even happened was because he was afraid of the panic. And because once Teddy Roosevelt's administration was over and Taft came into power, Taft also was afraid there could be another panic. But there was another reason that the Federal Reserve was created that doesn't get discussed a lot in history books, and that is that America itself was at its crossroads of power. America was looking at the world and saying, we need a central bank to be more competitive with England, we need a central bank to be competitive with France, and we need to have a unified currency, because at the time, banks were all issuing their own notes, and you could go and basically get notes backed by individual banks, and so if one bank failed, all of their notes failed, and it had a big negative effect on everything else. And so this idea was that if you had one consolidated place that issued Federal Reserve notes, issued currency as well, that that would strengthen this idea and sort of unify this whole process. And that was something that J.P. Morgan was interested in. It was also something that President Taft was interested in. And it was something that a man named Senator Nelson Aldrich was interested in. He was the senior senator from Rhode Island, and he ran the Senate Finance Committee at the time, the Senate Banking Committee at the time. These people came, they got together. One of them was Frank Vanderlip, who was the vice president of National City Bank and a protege of James Stillman. So Stillman was represented, National City Bank was represented, but everybody else there was really represented from the Morgan Bank. So who goes to Washington to present the plan they've just created but Frank Vanderlip from Citibank, National City Bank, and Henry Davidson, who became later one of the board members of the Federal Reserve. So those are the two guys that actually presented the plan that became the Federal Reserve. They also happened to be friends with Woodrow Wilson, who became president after Taft, and who ultimately signed the Federal Reserve Act in December 1913. There was a lot of sort of political back and forth going on between when Taft left and Wilson came in. Wilson campaigned against the bankers. He campaigned against this concentration of wealth in these money trusts. But he was friends with these people. Him and Frank Vanderlip used to hang out at Vanderlip's house in upstate New York and talk about events of the day when Woodrow Wilson was still president at Princeton University. Junius Morgan, who was the father of J.P. Morgan, used to donate money to Wilson when he was looking for money to run Princeton University. Yeah, the tie was pretty tight. So when he was talking against the money trust, he never actually mentioned any of them by name, but he did get elected on being a populist president, and he did sign the Federal Reserve Act, and he also took the country into World War I. The person that was by his side in terms of helping to finance World War I was Jack Morgan, the son of J.P. Morgan. After a year of being in office, a year and a bit, as war was starting to break out in Europe, Woodrow Wilson called Jack Morgan to the White House. And again, the press was all abuzz about this. There were reporters there. There were flashes. They were like, why is Jack Morgan at the White House? We thought that, the country thought that he and Wilson are sort of on different pages. And after this meeting, which was at noon, in the middle of the summer 1914, Jack Morgan comes out. Jack Morgan's a really private guy. So he doesn't talk to the press. In fact, he just tells the press, talk to Wilson. Woodrow Wilson then gets asked by the press, why was Morgan here? And all Woodrow Wilson says is, he was here at my pleasure. What it turned out was, through World War I, the Morgan Bank financed 75% of all war-related financings. And this wasn't, I didn't know that. I found out that number from this little report that went to Woodrow Wilson in one of his letters. It was a large percentage, and it wasn't so much that he was doing it separate from the White House, and that's a lot of the point in my book, is that these alliances aren't something that the bankers are imposing on the presidents. There's a mutually reinforcing collaboration that allows both of them to maintain powers in their separate orbits between politics and finance, but they really do work together. And back in the earlier part of the 20th century, they hung out together. They went to school together. They were engaged in social activities together. They liked each other. They trusted each other. They ran things together. One was elected, and one wasn't. And that's also where some of the democracy starts to break down, because we elect the president. We don't elect these bankers, and yet the influence tends to be pretty equal. And so that really, really eats away at what we have as a democracy, whether or not they make good decisions together or bad decisions together, whether or not it helps the population or in many cases hurts the population. But for World War I, the Treasury Department and Wilson were all on board with having Morgan take care of financing. He instructed other banks where they would place funds. He was working with increasing the level of war bonds that were sold through individuals to help finance the war. He was involved in a lot. As were his partners at National City Bank and at Chase, but mostly orchestrated by the Morgan Bank. And this is one of the reasons why the Morgan Bank was so influential in World War I and also into World War II. During the time between World War I and the crash in 1929, there was tremendous speculation again. Everybody forgot the lessons of the panic of 1907. We now had a Fed to back banks, and there was a lot of shadiness going on, particularly because of international plays that the bankers thought they could now do. So trading into Latin or giving loans into Latin America, looking at sugar constellations in Latin America and so forth, where they could really get speculators to invest and sort of turn that into profit for the bankers. And a lot of that stuff was based on faulty numbers and speculation, and nobody looking in Washington asked what the bankers were doing, because at the time the regulations didn't exist, and from World War I through to 1929 there were three separate presidents who did nothing or didn't care to do anything to stop the sort of party of speculation of the stock market bubble. It was after the war, this was the time to do it, America was about America, the bankers were about America supposedly, and none of the presidents from Harding to Coolidge to Hoover wanted to do anything to stop the party. So that was the period during which the bubble of the crash in 1929 happened. When the market crashed and it fell on the faces of the general population, that's when FDR came in. When FDR came in, he wanted to do something, obviously, to stabilize the country economically, but also to stabilize the banking system. Now, he was also friends with the Morgans. Again, the two families were pretty interlocked going back to the beginning of the century. And when it came time, though, to separate banks and to remove speculation from the depositors' money, from the citizens' money, and stabilize the country, FDR actually went up against the Morgans. Even though he was friends with them, he actually went against them because they didn't want a separation of speculation and deposits because they didn't have a lot of deposits. That's not the kind of bank they were. They did big things with big companies and big countries. They didn't want to have any sort of separation of being able to issue debt into countries and to have any sort of speculative power to decide which countries they were going to issue debt into. But Winthrop Aldrich was now head of Chase. And he saw things differently. He decided that actually it would be better to have the bank separated. And Winthrop Aldrich worked with Roosevelt to create Glass-Steagall Act, to separate the speculative activities from the depositors, because he thought that it would be better for the country if people had confidence in the banks. In fact, Roosevelt felt it would be better for the country, not just domestically, but also, you know, on the sort of emerging superpower stage if things were solid at home. And in the first 8 days that FDR was in office, Aldrich and the new head of National City Bank, James Perkins, those two guys knew Roosevelt very well, and they actually promoted his efforts, and he, in return, helped stabilize their banks. Now, they also had personal motives, which is that they wanted to compete against the Morgan Bank, which had done all this war financing and which they had been competing with for years. They wanted to sort of be supreme to the Morgan Bank, so that was an ulterior motive. But they could also sort of straddle this idea of the public being more secure as well as they being more powerful and having this alliance with the president because it made sense to them. So at the time, things were going really on both fronts. And through World War II, the Chase Bank became more involved in financing as a result. So again, there was another business motive for that, as did National City Bank. Because the head of National City Bank had supported FDR, he turned to them for support in return. And as a result, National City Bank started to become its own preeminent bank in the Big Six because it was the primary bank that issued war bonds and that its head went around the country with the Treasury Secretary, with Morgenthau, who was the Treasury Secretary of FDR, to gather funds from individuals by promoting the idea of war bonds in return for also opening accounts with National City Bank. So it was a good way to basically raise money for the war as well as to increase their deposit base. So, you know, again, they had ulterior motives. And as a result, after the war, National City Bank started growing in importance. And it was also because of a personal alliance between the head of National City Bank and the FDR administration.
I'll get by.
You're listening to Making Contact. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. On this edition, Nomi Prinz, author of All the President's Bankers, talks about the close-knit relationship between American banks and presidents. Up next, Prinz outlines the shift that took place as banks grew more interested in expanding into international markets.
Fast forward through the 40s, through the 60s. After the war, Eisenhower was considering whether he should vote Republican, be Republican, be Democrat, not run at all. And it was really a series of bankers who just made him be Republican and just wanted him to be president. And in return, during his administration, he helped them expand globally. So after World War II and during the Cold War, his doctrine was such that the United States politically and militarily now would back countries around the world that were leaning capitalists, and they would fight against countries or protect countries from other countries that were communist. But the financial aspect of the Cold War was really aligned on the same side, because Chase and National City Bank and all the guys that were running them wanted to expand themselves. And so they worked with Eisenhower to set up branches and outposts and regions throughout the world where they thought they could have a stronghold militarily and from a new open trade perspective, and they could open up branches. And as they were opening these branches in the 50s, American military power, Eisenhower was behind them. On a personal basis, they were all really good friends. The amount of correspondence between Eisenhower, and of course he had been at Columbia, but he didn't really grow up as a banker. He just forged these really tight relationships immediately with everyone who was anyone out of the Big Six banking community. And they in turn just had this very lovely correspondence where Eisenhower allowed them to grow domestically as well, and many mergers took place in finance in the 50s, and he also backed them internationally, and they backed him. And he asked a lot from these bankers who were not necessarily in his cabinet, who were not even appointed. He had bankers in his cabinet as well, but just to help him with economic strategy. And some of them really pushed it in their behalf. And there was this one guy, George Whitney, he said to him, for example, when Eisenhower was looking at tax policies for the United States, whether they should reduce taxes for corporations or reduce them for individuals, and George Whitney fervently pushed Eisenhower not to reduce taxes on corporations at the expense of individuals, because he, even though he was a banker, said, I think that money in the pockets of the citizens actually means more to the overall economy than it does with these companies. They're doing okay. And I mention that not necessarily to glorify George Whitney, but to say that there was this period in our history, which is very, very different from where we've gotten to now, where these alliances were tight, the personal, the political, financial, and all of that, but there was something in them that was actually beneficial or could sort of at least envision, though not perfectly, the fact that if you had a stronger economy from the ground up, that might be better for everyone as opposed to being completely self-serving and sociopathic, which is what I would say. So, but what happened was between the 60s and the 70s is that sort of idea started to break down. When JFK came into office for the short time that he was there, he had relationships with bankers. In fact, he and David Rockefeller, who was coming to the forefront of the Chase Bank at this point, he had been in the bank for a couple decades and was slated to become its chairman, he wanted the country to continue to sort of do what it was doing under Eisenhower, which was to back more financial expansion into these countries, to back more private interests into these countries. And JFK kind of didn't want to do that. He believed that allowing Latin America to be safe on its own and to be economically stable on its own was actually better for America. And that to have too much private investment and to turn it into sort of international hands was negative for America and negative for Latin America. And so on those two things, they didn't see eye to eye. And that was kind of where a little break started to happen between these alliances of you do this for me, I do this for you, and we'll both get power and we'll both sort of at least do something for the country as well. Though David Rockefeller then started to get very public about his disagreements, he actually wrote against JFK. It was the first time a sort of private citizen, a banker, had written against JFK and against his policies. And that sort of started a rift. But JFK learned quickly, and he decided to get the bankers back on board, and he started to give them concessions up through the time where he was assassinated. 4 days after that, David Rockefeller writes a letter to LBJ, the new president, where he doesn't miss a beat. He starts talking about what LBJ can do in terms of his Latin American policy, and LBJ decides that his policy will be about private interests in Latin America, and it's not just David Rockefeller, it's Walter Wriston, who's now a fellow who's rising to the head of National City Bank, and those two banks are now doing a lot of opening into that country and that area, and sort of disregarding what they can do nationally, what they can do in America, because all of a sudden expansion internationally seems much, much, much more profitable. By the time Nixon came around and Nixon took the country off the gold standard, because bankers wanted this idea of having less assets behind money because that meant more free investment, then everything started going in opposite directions. The bankers found that in addition to not having this restriction, they found oil in the Middle East. Profits that were now coming out of their branches and their newly forged relationships in the Middle East, they had extra money from the outside too. So because they had extra money that could recycle into debt in the third world and so forth, they didn't have to be even, they had less accountability even to being aligned on a sort of positive public basis with the presidency. And then things started going haywire from there. So between the years afterwards, they pushed for more deregulation of their banking internationally and as well as domestically, and they started getting bailed out for their mistakes in epic ways. So the third world debt crisis that happened in the 1980s under Reagan and under the first Bush was a direct result of that disalignment in those policies and those sort of self-interested policies that enabled them to take more bets at the expense of the government, at the expense of the American people. And the third world debt crisis was an example where the government did rally substantially to help them bail their bets out. That was followed in the 90s under Clinton by the 1994 Mexican peso crisis, by the Asian crisis, by a series of crises where in different ways the government stood in to bail out these bankers, and the relationships were not as close and personal as they had been over the many decades in the beginning of the century. They became just more functional. And the Bushes from 1900 under George Walker, one of the sort of patriarchal Bushes, had a bank that became part of Merrill Lynch, which has become part of Bank of America. So again, this is like a 100-year connection that ultimately got to a position in Washington where deregulation started happening in the 80s under Bush's task force, which Reagan asked Bush to create, with these men who pushed deregulation in Congress. And the reason they did it now was not about American superiority, it was about American competitiveness. And they said that if America had to compete in today's globe, the politicians, the treasury secretaries from these banks, as well as the bankers on their sides, wanted to make sure that they had no impediments, that they were as unregulated as possible, and that they had as much money to use as possible if things went wrong. And kind of that's where we wound up from here. In 1999, under Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who was a former co-CEO of Goldman Sachs in the Clinton administration, who helped Clinton get elected, and the sort of new set of families that have now become more preeminent along with the old Bushes in Washington, there was more deregulation. The Glass-Steagall Act was appealed in 1999, and that created this avalanche of speculation that ultimately came down on everybody in 2008. The banks had done so much bad betting after the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act because they had merged so substantially, and everybody was fine with that from the Treasury Secretary up through the Federal Reserve, that they backed these policies. And the result, ultimately, was the subprime crisis of 2008 and the bailouts that have been epic, and the fact that the Federal Reserve today, which had started as a bank to the banks, now for the big six banks, has done substantially more support in the form of an epic amount of subsidies, which equate to $4.2 trillion of securities buying, treasury securities and mortgage securities from these banks, which are sitting on the books of the Fed. That has just been unprecedented in history, that the required reserves that the Fed wants to supposedly make banks secure and have money in the back pocket in case something goes wrong is $86 billion. The banks have reserved $2.5 trillion as part of that whole Federal Reserve book. That's doing nothing to help anybody. So while you're getting 0% interest on your savings accounts, they've got $2.5 trillion of money parked at the Fed getting 0.25%, which isn't a lot, but it's still more than what you're getting, on the bonds that they have parked at the Federal Reserve doing nothing. And meanwhile, the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, after Ben Bernanke, is talking about how they're a job creation mechanism. Well, that's really not what they were ever created to do. They were created to support the banking system. That is really what they've done. And the trillions of dollars on their books is just indicative of where we've gotten to because of these political financial alliances and this philosophical alliance as well as to American competitiveness and what is needed. And strong banks make a strong country as opposed to strong people make a strong country. And strong foundation of economics for everybody is a stronger way to be. We have this sort of top-heavy situation where the banks are just getting a tremendous amount of subsidies, not passing it on. And worse than that, the concentration of that wealth today, the concentration of the risk that is behind that wealth, because all the times in our past when we've had low interest rates, when we've allowed the kind of betting, when we've backed the betting, there's always been a worse financial crisis afterwards. That's just been what history has said. And if there's no accountability at the top of these institutions, then there's nothing to counter that danger and that possibility of a bigger crisis happening again. It's hard to understand the logic of post-2008 crisis that we still have made the big banks bigger and that we've created more subsidies and more bailouts than we have before, and that no one in Washington seems to think, you know, absent a couple senators, seems to think this is a problem, certainly not at the level of Obama, certainly not at the leadership level. There's this willingness to believe, absent personal relationships, absent accountability, that somehow the banks are better and somehow the economy is better, when in fact it isn't. And they're not. They're just subsidized very, very well. But I've thought about it a lot, and I've gotten this idea from the 30s to the 60s, where, again, everything wasn't perfect, but at least there was some notion of a little bit of public interest creeping into the political financial policy discussions, that we have to take some of this stuff back. But we are together, and we can do things like support anything local and anything community and anything credit union-like and you know, buying books from third-place books and whatever it is that starts to establish these alliances at the bottom up. Because honestly, if you go back 100 years, yes, there was a lot of money and power in these alliances, but what made them so strong in terms of impacting the country was that they existed, was that they worked together, was that they tied themselves together. And I think what happens a lot when you think of the amount of just lack of leadership and sort of economic danger and strife that's in the country, that you know, what can we possibly do? But we can sort of learn from this idea of creating alliances with each other, with our local finance companies, with our credit unions, and as I've mentioned, with our communities, with our people at work, with our families, spreading knowledge and doing things together in a way that actually binds us better. Because I think, and as it happened in the 30s, a change in this country is going to come from two places. It's come from a massive crisis or many crises that will continue to impact the country, or it's going to come from the bottom up, and it's going to come from our awareness and our connections to each other and our not going home and doing nothing and our not being isolated, because isolationism was and is what hurts the country, whereas working together and supporting and creating alliances actually helps the country and helps individuals, helps us feel more empowered as well.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Those were excerpts from a speech by Nomi Prinz about her book, All the President's Bankers, originally recorded by Pirate TV on June 17, 2014. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about Wall Street's relationship with the White House? Leave us a comment at radioproject.org. Or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Laura Flynn. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.